This is Parents' Rights Now. The answer is you. Train. Speak. Change. Parents and allies standing together, millions of voices speaking as one. Stop messing with our kids. It ends here.
Hey, everybody. This is the week of May 15th. And yesterday was Mother's Day. So I've been a mother for almost 50 years. It's hard to imagine. I never thought I would live to see the day when my own child would be older than I was when he was born. Isn't that kind of miraculous? These are concepts that we're all very aware of, but until we actually experience them, we don't know what they mean, do we? You gotta be there. If you're a mother, do you remember that very first Mother's Day? As children, we all experience honoring our mothers and, you know, bringing her flowers from somebody else's yard or, you know, taking her breakfast in bed, whatever the tradition was in your household, you can't forget Mother's Day. And of course, at school, the teachers usually made that a project, you know, for the Friday before Mother's Day. All the kids made a card or did something in recognition of their mothers. The day that you actually become a mother is quite a humbling revelation, isn't it? Because you know that there's huge responsibility. And I've talked about this before. It's the most humbling job you will ever undertake, being a mom. And of course, being a dad too, but we're going to talk about moms today. And it's not only implicit in, you know, everybody's mind, but it's talked about in the Bible, Old and New Testament, which I think is important to point out. You know, we're not a religious organization. Parents' Rights in Education focuses on the rights that we have in the United States of America in relationship to parents and their children. In the Old Testament, Exodus 20:12, it says, and this is from what? The Ten Commandments. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. And in the New Testament, Ephesians 6:1-4, it states, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on earth. Wow. That's a big one, isn't it? So what's the difference between respect and honor? Now, I'm talking about this because my husband and I had a very interesting discussion this morning, reflecting on Mother's Day and what it really means to honor versus just respect. So these are concepts that are often used interchangeably, but they have different meanings and implications. Respect is the recognition of someone's values, qualities, or achievements, while honor is the recognition of someone's integrity, dignity, and moral values. But honor is also a verb, meaning to show that you appreciate and value that individual through words and through actions. All of this is to say that if you know the Bible or not, all people recognize the implicit relationship between parents and their children. And our laws should protect that relationship and not interfere with or negate it. Parents' rights are inalienable, meaning that they are implicit and cannot be denied. And our Constitution protects our inalienable rights. That is the purpose of government, the role of government, is to protect our rights. So let's not forget that. The very first Mother's Day was established in the United States by a woman named Ann Reeves Jarvis. Following her mother's 1905 death, she conceived of Mother's Day as a way of honoring the sacrifices mothers made for their children. After gaining financial backing from a Philadelphia department store owner, John Wanamaker, in May of 1908, she organized the very first official Mother's Day celebration at a Methodist church in Grafton, West Virginia. That same day also saw thousands of people attend a Mother's Day event at one of Wanamaker's retail stores in Philadelphia. Following the success of her first Mother's Day, Jarvis, who remained unmarried and childless her entire life, resolved to see her holiday added to the national calendar. Arguing that American holidays were biased toward male achievements, she started a massive letter-writing campaign to newspapers and prominent politicians, urging the adoption of a special day honoring motherhood. So she wasn't a mother herself, but she wanted to bring attention to women. By 1912, many states, towns, and churches had adopted Mother's Day as an annual holiday, and Jarvis had established the Mother's Day International Association to help promote her cause. Her persistence paid off in 1914 when President Woodrow Wilson signed a measure officially establishing the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day. But later, while Jarvis had initially worked with the floral industry to help raise Mother's Day's profile, by 1920, she became disgusted with how the holiday had been commercialized. Now, I want to remind you guys, you can't separate business from providing a service and products. We are in control of what we buy, right? So this is not also the role of government. The role of government is to provide for freedom to do what you want. Nobody's forcing anyone to buy a card or flowers. Remember when you were little, you would go to your neighbor's yard and pick a flower and take it to your mother. We're not compelled to do that or forced to do that. It's a personal choice. But Jarvis was mad about that, and she outwardly denounced the transformation and urged people to stop buying Mother's Day flowers, cards, and candies. She eventually resorted to an open campaign against Mother's Day profiteers, speaking out against confectioners, florists, and even charities. She also launched countless lawsuits against groups that had used the name Mother's Day. She thought she owned the term, eventually spending most of her personal wealth in legal fees. And by the time of her death in 1948, Jarvis had disowned the holiday altogether and even actively lobbied the government to see it removed from the American calendar. Actually, she was a feminist and an anti-capitalist. By the way, our Constitution also protects the right to enter into contract. And every time we buy something, that's what we're doing. I know it's a little bit abstract maybe for some of you. You haven't thought about that. But you do enter into contract when you purchase an item. It's mutually agreed contract that's followed through with payment right then and there. People need to understand not only our rights, but also our economics and the fact that our economic system is based upon individual freedom. Well, lately, we've been seeing a huge push, especially in light of Roe v. Wade, the overturning of that Supreme Court decision to attack parents' rights. There are two significant bills, almost identical, that are making their way through state legislatures. One in the state of Oregon, incredible. And I've talked about House Bill 2002 previously, written about it and talked about it. So this is a report from the local newspaper called the Statesman's Journal in Salem, Oregon. Oregon lawmakers, you know, have been intent on passing this legislation. They say that would protect and decrease gaps in access to quote, reproductive and gender affirming healthcare, unquote. And those efforts have been stymied, at least temporarily, by Republican senators who walked out of the legislature. House Bill 2002 explicitly lists reproductive and gender affirming healthcare that would require insurance coverage by any health benefit plan in the state of Oregon, including abortion, contraceptives, sexually transmitted infections screening, and even electrolysis and facial surgery. And you probably wonder, well, what does that have to do with healthcare? Well, that's part of the transgender menu. So the bill also clarifies that Oregon minors under the age of 15 are able to receive abortions without parental consent or notification. Some say that includes nine-year-olds. Well, it would include anyone who is able to conceive at a young age, wouldn't it? At least 13 states have triggered laws to ban abortion in the first and second trimesters following the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. And dozens of other states have worked toward restricting or banning abortion with legislation that would limit or completely block the access to this type of care. Anti-LGBTQ legislation has followed a similar trend. So this bill passed the House of Representatives and it's going through the Senate. Four senators have nine unexcused absences. If the leaders fail to reach an agreement by 10:30 a.m. today, that's Monday, today, when the Senate is scheduled to reconvene, they could hit 10 unexcused absences. And that would trigger, under Measure 113, it would bar them from running for re-election. So, you know, that's a big deal here because we have four senators who would not be able to run for re-election in the state of Oregon. Oregon is one of four states with a requirement of a two-thirds quorum to conduct business. In the Senate, 20 of its 30 members must be present to hold a session. Texas, Tennessee, and Indiana are the other three states with a similar rule. Due to that threshold, walkouts have become a powerful tool for minority lawmakers. We are really proud of these lawmakers for taking that stand. And this particular law is especially concerning when it comes to abortion, but even more so, in my opinion, when it comes to parental rights. Because as I've stated before, in the state of Oregon, if a parent does not recognize and affirm their child's decision to change their sex or identify as the opposite sex, Child Protective Services can be notified and they can lose custody of their own children. That's hard to imagine that in this day and age where that literally authoritarian and tyrannical, it's none of the state's business what parents do in relation to decisions like this pertaining to their own children. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all of the details. You guys know it, but I'm just sitting here, you know, perplexed that a human adult could possibly think this is okay for someone else's minor child, that the state can take their child away from them. But this is all wrapped up in this bill, House Bill 2002. Alvin Louie is reporting on a bill that is moving through the Maine legislature. It's titled LD 1735, and it's a proposed piece of legislation that has garnered national attention for its potential to allow the state of Maine to override parental consent in all 50 states. Oh, he's saying it just has the potential to. This bill would allow out-of-state children, and the same thing, by the way, would happen in the state of Oregon. It would allow out-of-state children to cross into Maine and obtain transgender treatments such as breast binding, penis tucking, irreversible puberty blockers, cross-sex hormone drugs, or mutilation surgeries. Parents would lose custody of their children if they do not support these treatments, and the children would become wards of the state with their treatments paid through tax-funded programs. Proponents of the bill argue that it's necessary to protect the rights of transgender children who may be subjected to abuse or neglect by their parents. Now, keep in mind, it doesn't say that if they choose to abuse or neglect their children, they could be prosecuted, which is the case. But they're basing it on this particular viewpoint. This blatant and false emotional blackmail originated with school counselors and school and social workers in public K-12 schools. Well, I agree with Louie on that point. The American School Counselor Association and the National Association of Social Workers train their members to be transgender cult recruiters, and their go-to is parents are unsafe and abusive. This bill, LD-394, will expand the powers of school mental health professionals to be able to keep transgender secrets from parents. And we know this is happening. Opponents of the bill, on the other hand, argue that it is a violation of parental rights and that it would set a dangerous precedent for the state to override the decisions of parents when it comes to their children's health care. Absolutely, it would do that. And they are arguing that these treatments are highly controversial and potentially dangerous, and that parents should have the final say in whether or not their children undergo them. It's amazing, guys, isn't it, that we're even having to state this, that someone would have the gall to write a bill like this, even suggesting that the state can override a parent's ability to be involved in irreversible medical procedures, I would say experimental medical procedures, that would change a child's life forever. No 8-year-old knows what they want in life, let alone a 20-year-old, right? I don't know about you, but at 20, I was still pretty immature. I mean, I had a lot of maturity, actually, probably more than some adults. Well, I would say more than the adults who wrote this bill. But most young people don't have a clue, especially if they've never been through puberty. And the idea that the state can take control of a child's decision-making when they're 8 or younger is unconstitutional. We got to stop this, you guys. It's over. Stop messing with our kids. It ends here. This is Parents' Rights. Now, please check your show notes for links. If you agree with us, why not consider making a monthly contribution to Parents' Rights in Education? We are a tax-deductible nonprofit organization and depend on contributors like you who contribute in small amounts every month. This is a crisis. It's a national crisis. Give today. ParentsRightsInEducation.com.